A deal to house the homeless could cost the city of Jacksonville millions. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, get our podcast. Just subscribe through the WJCT app and listen anytime. You can also listen to this show right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, a proposed settlement between the city of Jacksonville and disability rights activists leading to housing for the homeless in Springfield. Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, it's a growing problem in the Sunshine State, elderly abuse, particularly digital abuse. We'll tell you about a new report and author and financial planner, Jeanette Bajalia. Her new book, Planning a Purposeful Life, lays out the keys to happy longevity, especially for women. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it's been a dispute in Springfield for years now. Here's what is at issue. Ability Housing, the nonprofit that works to find permanent housing for Jacksonville's homeless, is to be allowed to turn a 12-unit complex on Cottage Avenue into a home for the disabled and chronically homeless. Now, many Springfield residents say they're opposed to this deal that's been hammered out, and they want the city to go to court to stop the agreement. Springfield residents say there just wasn't enough community input. But the U.S. Justice Department found Springfield's historic overlay violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. And this federal settlement is expected to cost taxpayers millions of dollars. This has been a long-running story, and we have the latest right now as we welcome Shannon Nasworth, Executive Director of Ability Housing. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments about this settlement that mandates the city approve a housing complex permit for the disabled and homeless in Springfield? This legal settlement between the city and two disability rights groups is expected to cost Jacksonville quite a bit of money due to the legal action. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. All right. Now, you're very familiar with this, of course. You've been dealing with this for years. But for some of our listeners, this may be quite new information. Let's bring them up to date and explain where things are with this settlement and why this is so significant for Ability Housing and for Springfield.
Absolutely. So basically, the story is that 3 years ago, we received a grant from the state to purchase a 12-unit apartment building. We were going to rehab it and then rent the apartments to disabled veterans. At the time, there was some neighborhood backlash. They did not want us to be acquiring the property and renting to those individuals, and they requested the city block the property.
And why were they against it?
Well, what they stated was they didn't want to have any more homeless or disability projects in their
community.
In Springfield.
So in Springfield, there was this almost, it's an overused acronym, but a NIMBY kind of backlash.
Yes. I mean, it literally meets the definitions of NIMBY.
Yeah.
People would say it's not that we know you do a good job, we know you'll do a good job, it's all those types of things, just not in our neighborhood. Historically, Springfield did have a very high concentration of facilities that serve the disabled. So in 2000, when they passed the zoning overlay to try and help rehabilitate Springfield, one of the things they did was bar certain facilities from being in that 1 square mile historic district. And this, what we were going to do was not any of those. We were literally just buying an apartment building, going to turn what is really a deteriorating property into a nice quality housing, and then rent it to formerly homeless veterans.
Mm-hmm.
However, because of the ambiguities in the Springfield overlay, the city said that it was close to, although not actually, like a group home or other type of facility, and therefore not permitted within the Springfield neighborhood. And we appealed that decision from the city and appealed it several times over the course of a couple of years and were denied our appeals. And so ultimately did have to take the city to court, suing them for violation of the Fair Housing Act as well as the Americans with Disabilities Act.
The Department of Justice also sued.
Yes. Because of the repeated denials, the Department of Justice opened an investigation, informed the city, did all of their due diligence, and then later informed the city that their findings were that they were in violation of both the Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there are three plaintiffs in this case.
And because DOJ found this, or our court found this, the city now has to pay out a couple of million bucks, isn't that right?
Well, so where we're at the moment is, one, that project itself is dead. The state had to rescind the grant funds, so that project will not be going forward regardless of the outcomes of the settlement agreement. However, because the zoning was used in a way to bar that project, that's what brought to light the discriminatory language within the zoning overlay. And that's what the Department of Justice sued with regards to. What we were able to do is work with the Department of Justice, the city, and Disability Rights Florida, and negotiate a settlement. And so in that settlement, basically, they'll fix the discriminatory language in the zoning overlay. It's very laser focused. It's just focused on that particular discriminatory language. The city will have to refund Ability Housing a portion of our expenses and legal fees. Disability Rights will be funded a portion of their expenses as well. And then there's a $25,000 fine to the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. More importantly,
$2 million in all, though, isn't that's been reported.
Yeah, the other part is that the city will have to fund a like grant. So what they'll do is use their existing federal pass-through resources that are targeted for affordable housing and must be used for affordable housing. They'll just direct some of those resources towards a grant to do a like project. It's not going to Ability Housing. Will be eligible to compete for the resources. However, if the better project is presented, then it will get funded.
What do you think this whole saga says about the difficulties of trying to house difficult-to-place homeless people, disabled people, and this whole minefield that you've been through?
Well, I think it shows several things. One, first and foremost, there's been a long community conversation for several years about the stigma associated with mental health. JCCI did their study, and there's been lots of coverage of that over the last 3 years as well. Interesting, going on the same timeline. And I think that was where a lot of the fear from the neighborhood came from, was they were told incorrect information about what we would and would not be doing. And then there's just the stigma associated with certain homeless individuals, that they'll, you know, bring bad activities to the neighborhood and be a detriment to the neighborhood. The research shows that that's not true. In fact, NYU did a study assessing 7,500 units of permanent supportive housing in New York City in 123 complexes, and it showed none of those negative impacts.
What has been your response all along to Springfield residents who have made the argument that, look, our neighborhood does more than its share to house struggling people?
Well, we have housing all over Duval County. We're spread everywhere. There isn't a neighborhood where we don't have housing, and most of the time the neighborhood is not aware we're there. Springfield did historically have a very high concentration of what were not appropriate facilities. It's a shame on everybody that anyone had to live in those facilities. That issue has since changed. And the licensing and regulatory nature of those facilities, they would not permit that activity to occur today, in addition to which most of those facilities have closed, and there's a very reduced number of that activity in Springfield today.
On the other side of the coin, what's your response to those who've been critical of the complaints coming from Springfield? They see hypocrisy in some of the Springfield residents' complaints against this settlement, that they give lip service to wanting to help disenfranchised and struggling people, but they don't want it in their own backyard.
Well, you know, I can always understand people's home is their major investment and it's where they're raising their family. So it is where the most emotional response is going to come from. The reality is that that's not what we do. In every community where we've done a project, we've been asked to do more because we're a really good neighbor. We've tried to reach out to the Springfield neighborhood, and many residents have been responsive and over the years have come to learn that what they thought was going to happen isn't the reality. The fact of the matter is that we have an incredibly good case. The DOJ has an incredibly good case. It's in everybody's best interest, including the Springfield neighborhood, for this settlement agreement to be approved by City Council, because if it isn't, then it does go to federal court, and it'll be much more expensive.
It was a fight over just 12 units of housing in Springfield, and it led to a federal settlement that will cost Jacksonville some $2 million. What are your questions right now about this flap that's been going on in Springfield for years as we speak with Shannon Asworth of Ability Housing? We want to hear from every neighborhood. 549-2937. Paul is in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Go ahead.
I, you know, have the most deep feelings about homeless people in a nation that is as wealthy as we are. You know, $2 million is dropping the bucket. Look, they spend $30 million on a new scoreboard for the Jaguars. And, you know, we can't afford $2 million. And a lot of these people, as I think you mentioned, are veterans who have not made the transition, you know, from being in combat back into, you know, ordinary civilian life. And we owe them everything. for putting their lives on the line to protect us from terrorists. And I strongly disagree with anybody who thinks that we shouldn't do that.
Thanks, Paul. And to be clear, the $2 million is only being paid out because the city wouldn't allow you to build this house, to set up this housing in the first place.
Correct.
This is the settlement that's being paid out over the legal action.
Exactly.
What would it have cost initially without all of this back and forth?
Well, it wouldn't have cost the city anything. The money we were going to use to do the project originally is state money, so the city would not have had any expense.
It's 549-2937. Kevin along I-95. Hey, Kevin. Good morning.
Good morning. Melissa, I have I've been working in Springfield developing affordable housing, mixed income housing for, gosh, close to 18 years. And, you know, I think what the message has been going around the community with regards to this issue has been really toxic for Springfield. You know, over the last 18 years, we've built close to 85 properties down in that area. And what we've learned that, and of course we have a prison reentry program that has a lot of folks that are homeless and across the board that are in Springfield, but we've done it in a way that was a collaborative way with the community. I mean, we had a property that we just built or just closed on a couple of months ago on 8th Street that's going to be low income property and mixed income. And yes, there were some challenges from the community, but when we spent time explaining with the community, working with the community, and having the community's engagement, you know, we were able to get buy-in in what we do. And I just feel this property has put a lot of things at risk in our community with regards to the ability for us to work with communities and being able to push these an important project like this through. But you can't come in and kind of blindside a community with a property like this and without having the kind of buy-in that is important to do that with regards to really community development. And so I'm Springfield's a community that's near and dear to my heart, and I think Springfield's come across as a community that doesn't want homeless people, doesn't want veterans, which is just absolutely incorrect across the board. And so I just think the message needs to be appropriate in the process.
Thanks, Kevin. That's Kevin Gay on the line, Operation New Hope. Kevin, thanks for calling in as you're out there driving around town. Okay, what about his comments?
Well, I agree. And, you know, we did try to reach out to the community. Candidly, you know, we were buying a deteriorating building and going to be investing heavily in it and creating a really nice property. We did not realize the Springfield community would have this kind of reaction to that kind of investment in their neighborhood. Once we had the issue, we did have community meetings. We also had myriads of one-on-one meetings with residents or small group meetings because there was a lot of incorrect information being told about what we were going to do.
What were people thinking you were going to do?
They were being told it was going to be a homeless shelter or a treatment facility, that there were going to be pedophiles, that it was just anything and everything that to a certain degree was fear-mongering. And some of it, you know, the people knew that that wasn't the reality of what we were going to be doing, but the word got out there very, very quickly. We had multiple community meetings, and it is unfortunate. I mean, it has been a learning experience for Ability Housing, and we're hopeful that the Springfield community can move past this, because there are actually a lot of Springfield residents who have spoken out in favor of our project and who have testified at City Council that they want this settlement to pass because they realize there's discriminatory language.
And let's be clear, this isn't a done deal yet. The final vote will be held at the City Council on March 28th.
Correct.
To close the loop on this thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If the City Council doesn't approve it, then we have to go to federal court.
Oh, really? Okay. So we could have, this could be going on. Do you think you have the votes to close this out on the council?
We're very hopeful. We don't know for sure. We've been meeting with council members, and the committee meetings actually start next week, so I think we'll know a lot more then. We also did meet with Councilman Gaffney. He held a meeting and welcoming the Springfield residents to come discuss the zoning changes that are being proposed so that we could get their feedback. If there is a change that would be beneficial to the Springfield community that is related to the settlement, we're very open to that. If there are other issues with regards to the zoning that Springfield wants to address, Councilman Gaffney has said that he'll gladly discuss those and have separate legislation unrelated to the settlement.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for Shannon Nasworth of Ability Housing, 549-2937, to join us. Hank on the north side. Hey, Hank. Good morning.
How you doing?
All right.
Well, I think this is a long time coming because if you look at the business community, we see homeless in places where we don't want them because we may think that they are distractions. Now, you do have some homeless that do who are mentally challenged and who may need some assistance as far as you may be outspoken in the area where you may need some type of security to watch over and make sure they don't do themselves no harm or the other people. But as far as, you know, where the location is, this just a long time coming because they do need somewhere to stay. You know, a lot of them don't mean any harm, but a lot of them, you know, they have been mentally destroyed because of lack of life, whatever they may have lost over the years. So if we get them some type of help in looking at that, I think it would be all right.
All right. Thanks, Hank. Yeah. And, you know, this whole ordeal is a case study in what happens when you try to rehouse homeless people, which everyone in theory wants.
Yes.
Where the when the rubber meets the road is where you get into some trouble. Where is the housing going to be? How's it going to be paid for? What are all the devil's always in the details, and you've been through the ringer on this, and so is the neighborhood.
Yes. And you know, one thing about homelessness is we know what it takes to end homelessness. It is sometimes people feel it's intractable, but it's really not. There are solutions and they're well researched. And so if we can move past this, get the settlement in place, and then work collaboratively together, we can house all of the homeless people in Jacksonville and not and lead the nation in a way that would be very impactful for our community, but most importantly for those several thousand people that need a place to live.
Tina is on the line. Hi, Tina. Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for holding.
Hi, everybody. Shannon, hi. Interesting, all of this. And one of my big issues, I was a homeless advocate for many years. I am now disabled, and I'm a landowner and a homeowner. I can tell you what's causing homelessness recently, more so than when I was involved back in the 90s. Am I still on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Back in the 90s, the research we did in 91, 75% of our homeless, and I was in New England at the time, 75% of the homeless were children. You didn't see them, but they were there. Now, and homeless people used to help each other. They had their own coalition. They had their own lawyers. Everything's changed now on the street. Women get raped. They get forced into prostitution. So do children. The abduction of children for the sex crimes that are going on that we get grilled about, like in healthcare, you have to take a certain number of hours of continuing education on child trafficking just to get your license renewed, which is good because a lot of it takes place in the massage therapy industry as well. You know, with all the problems we've got in our country right now, everyone, even those that have nice homes and nice jobs, those people are stressed too. So imagine being scared you're going to lose your home because you're disabled and your income is not enough to manage your home. For example, if you needed to improve or replace your home because maybe Hurricane Matthew took it away and the insurance company paid part, you got your deductible, but you needed more money and did not qualify for the Small Business Administration loans that were offered during this disaster we went through, they have a cutoff of income line, an income bar. If you don't make a certain amount of money every month, sorry, but we can't help you. And it's so interesting how that line is always drawn just a few dollars above what the average disabled vet or citizen or Social Security recipient is getting.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
okay,
when Obama gave us all a $32 cost of living increase, no one had done that in decades. Everybody was elated. Well, it pushed us $2 above the food stamp line income. He took away $173 of our food stamps. He took away our food
okay,
stamps.
Okay, Tina.
Now we did
all
not.
Right, Tina. I gotcha. I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Okay, so that her call expresses the frustration so many of these folks are feeling.
Absolutely.
And the fear.
And it is very fearful. And, you know, the most recent count that we have on the homeless is we have almost 2,000 people on a given day are homeless in Jacksonville. And studies say that if you take, you know, on average, in a year, about four times that number. So we have about 8,000 people who are homeless on our streets in Jacksonville, and then several thousand students in our public schools who are unstably housed. The fear and the anger and the frustration is very real.
549-2937. Kimberly is in Springfield. Hi, Kimberly. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I have lived in Springfield about 5 years now, and I'm pretty involved in the community. I just wanted to put out there that I feel it's just a bit disingenuous for Ms. Nasworth to frame the Springfield residents as being against helping the homeless or certainly against housing projects for the disabled or for veterans. I know that early on in this process, veterans were not a part of the discussion. And so we felt that bringing that word into it, trying to make it look like we're somehow against veterans, was just certainly not the case. We as a neighborhood, we face the realities of homelessness every day. There's a very significant transient population in our neighborhood, and we're very much about helping that community as much as we can. I think it's just the concerns that I was aware of early on were that this concentration, I believe, and maybe Ms. Nasworth can clarify, but I believe it was a housing first approach, and that approach comes without any requirements for ending substance abuse and things like that. And that may be mistaken, and perhaps you can correct that. But I think there was a concern of drug use on the property more than anything else.
Okay.
Or folks who were in need of care not getting it. And so, and then of course, you know, Springfield to thrive really needs a variety, a wide range of economic development. And so we're still not there from the concentration of services that were put into our neighborhood in the 80s. And so it's just that combination of factors. I don't want anybody to think that our neighborhood is at all not supportive of improving the lives of homeless people, disabled people, veterans. It couldn't be further from the truth.
Thanks, Kimberly. And here's a similar comment on our Facebook page. Francine writes, Springfield is trying to become a clean, safe, desirable neighborhood and keeps getting pushed back. Why not put this in a more stable area instead of one at the tipping point, like Mandarin, Avondale, or Riverside near the hospitals?
So, as I said, we have properties all over Duval County. We have them in Mandarin. In fact, I think most of our unit, the highest concentration of units that we have is in Mandarin. You know, there's a few things that were said there that I do believe Springfield is a very caring neighborhood. It's unfortunate that this has brought the contention that it has. But this particular site was picked for a myriad of reasons. One, it was always intended to serve veterans. It was picked because it's near the VA clinic. It's within just a couple of blocks, and we thought that would be a great resource for the veterans. It's near UF Health, which, you know, employment opportunities. FSCG downtown campus is very close by, so, you know, secondary education and job development, those types of things. And obviously there's a lot of public transportation available, et cetera. So the location was picked because we thought it would be the best to serve the people we wanted to serve. And that's a testament to Springfield. In addition, NYU did a study of 7,500 units of supportive housing in New York City at 123 apartment communities. And it was shown that those properties actually helped with neighborhood revitalization. They improved property values in comparison to like properties in the same neighborhood that weren't as close to the project. And, if we had been allowed to go forward, we would have been able to prove that we are a good neighbor. We do use the housing first approach. It's an evidence-based practice, and it is a best practice. It is how you help people exit homelessness rapidly. And basically, it just says that there's no preconditions to moving in other than some typical landlord-type screenings. For example, we do have screenings for certain criminal backgrounds and things like that. We don't allow pedophiles. We don't allow violent criminals with recent experiences. If something happened 20 years ago and somebody's, you know, we do believe in second chances, but it's not an open door to anyone. and they have to abide by their lease, which means you can't break the law. But if you want to have a beer, you can have a beer. That's not breaking the law. It really comes down to the same type of housing you and I live in. Our landlord doesn't come in and spot check our apartment. Our landlord doesn't come in and make sure, you know, do a blood test or a pee test or anything like that. If we're not breaking the lease, then our landlord doesn't get engaged.
Adam tweets the show, when the city was presented with the possibility of a lawsuit, what was their reaction? Seems wasteful for the city to litigate. Was it a mistake for Jacksonville to go to court on this now that they lost and they're paying to the tune of $2 million and that's on the taxpayers?
Obviously, I would agree with that. It is unfortunate it got to this point. We really did hope to not have to reach this point, but we just weren't able to prevail through our appeals, and so we had to go to court.
Again, the full council votes on this matter, this settlement, at the end of the month. We'll continue to follow the story here at 89.9 News. Thanks for sharing the latest with us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Shannon Nasworth is the executive director of Ability Housing in Jacksonville. And much more still ahead on the show later. Looking at ways to avoid outliving your savings. Longevity planning with Jeanette Bajalia will go inside the pages of her new book. But up next, fighting digital abuse against Florida's seniors. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, what does health care really cost? Regardless of what Congress does to the Affordable Care Act, Americans face higher premiums, prescription costs, and much higher deductibles. Why is that? Who sets the prices for healthcare? What is driving costs up? And can anything bring them down? That's next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
They say all politics is local, but state legislative news is really local. Laws from Tallahassee affect our everyday lives. That's why Florida public radio stations are teaming up with a preview of what's up for debate in this year's legislative session. Join us this week for in-depth coverage of education, healthcare, and environmental legislation, as well as proposed new gun laws. Decision Florida coverage during Morning Edition on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, the next Jazz Night in America, dissecting the magic of Cy Oliver.
Cy Oliver had a trademark of harmonized trio singing. He believed there was only one way to do anything, which was right.
A vocal trio led by Catherine Russell.
Cy used to come and just sit. If he liked something, he would just have this nice, pleasant look on his face.
That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's the latest thread in an alarming problem around Florida, elder abuse, specifically digital abuse of the elderly. Rising health care costs, a growing aging population, and the corporate restructuring of the state's nursing homes is putting Florida's elderly often in a dangerous situation. Florida has the greatest number of people over age 65, and with this exploding population, the state is looking at big challenges in how to care for them, as more will need long-term care in the next decades. With more, we welcome Joanne Haycox, Executive Director at Seniors on a Mission. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Steve Wattrell, attorney focused on elder abuse cases. Good to see you.
Thank you for having us.
What are your questions about elder abuse in Florida? Give us a call. 549-2937. And Steve, let's begin with you. You have just put out a report. It's called The State of Nursing Homes and Elder Abuse in Florida. Pretty alarming. What are the findings here?
Well, in terms of the digital abuse, what we're finding is this alarming trend in nursing home employees using their smartphones to take and post degrading and humiliating photographs of seniors on sites like Facebook and Snapchat. And recently, in a First Coast News investigative report, we saw just several weeks ago an employee doing a lap dance in front of a 100-year-old Alzheimer's patient who had no idea what was going on.
Oh, man. Just the cruelty and the stupidity of this is alarming enough. Are you finding that seniors are in physical danger at all as well? Or is it mainly cyber types of abuses like that?
Well, in the report, we also outline several frequent areas that we're seeing now with elder abuse in nursing home settings, the first being pressure ulcers or bed sores where, you know, seniors are not turned and repositioned. They're left to lay in their feces and urine for a long period of time. We see dehydration and malnutrition because they're dropping off meals and then just walking off and people can't eat by themselves. We're seeing lots of falls and drops because there's not enough staff to help bring the residents to the bathroom. And then the last thing the report outlines is sepsis, which is blood poisoning. We're seeing a lot of untreated infections just going on for days and weeks, which end up, leading to the death of seniors.
So what are the main things people need to research to ensure their loved one is not placed in this horrible kind of situation?
Well, you know, first I would recommend our senior guide that we've created, to help people with this entire process of the different types of facilities and the level of care, because that's probably the biggest determination is the level of care. And then we outline things like you have to look at how these certain nursing homes, how they're corporately owned, because a lot of the corporate facilities are going to have a lot more problems because they cut costs. Then you also want to look at things like the federal or state surveys, which are done on a yearly basis, and then there's complaint surveys. They're online, and people are not aware they're being done. But when you review them, you could see the problems and deficiencies they have, which would probably lead you away from certain facilities.
Do your research.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It's this process. It's sort of people will spend days and weeks looking at information on purchasing a car or a home or a wedding, and then when it comes to their parents or their grandparents or a loved one, they're literally making a decision in an hour. So in many cases when your loved one is going to be needing skilled nursing care or an assisted living, you need to be proactive and get on it right away and not wait until it's an emergency situation.
All right. Joanne Hickox, your founder and executive director of Seniors on a Mission, and you really know what it's like for seniors who are facing these challenges and their families. What are some of the biggest issues you're seeing, and is burnout a problem with caregivers at assisted living facilities? Is that leading to some of these abuses?
Well, burnout is huge with the family and with the facilities.
Uh-huh.
We find that seniors need to have so much care at a certain point that there's not enough people to go around. Facilities are losing people because the pay scale isn't so great. They get called in to do doubles. They're exhausted.
So the good people burn out and quit, maybe, and that leaves not so quality people who might be abusing grandma.
Yeah,
that's pretty scary
and unskilled. And uncaring.
And they don't know what to do. And in fact, you have a story to share about an 89-year-old lady that you see twice a week, and she's afraid to complain about the treatment at her facility?
Well, she's aware of the fact that if she complains, the people that are in charge of her care can retaliate. And she's very cautious about what she says to whom for fear of her own care.
That's so upsetting. And so not only that, in the first segment, we talked about housing for the homeless and all of the challenges that go along with that. As you find, there are flaws related to HUD housing for seniors as well. Can you share a little bit more about that?
You know, HUD housing was created to have a safe space for seniors that don't have housing. But it's all about housing. There isn't a whole lot connected with their personal and emotional needs. And the last time I was in a HUD housing place about a month ago, they were all huddled around the mailbox section waiting to see if something would come. And so the whole idea is we've got to get more personal with these people and not just house them and put them away.
Here in Florida, our population, Steve, of those 65 and older is expected to double by the year 2040. This means the problem will only grow ever more acute in Florida. And across the country, your report shows Over 90% of nursing homes in the U.S. lack adequate staff. So it's not just a Florida problem.
No, it's a national problem, and it's going to be catastrophic if we don't get on top of it. Unfortunately, our legislators always want to kick the can down the road, just as if you don't want to deal with a family situation where maybe your mom needs to go into a facility. But if we don't get on top of the situation, we're going to have a national catastrophe. And here in Florida, mm-hmm. since we have the highest number of seniors, we're going to be facing this problem a lot sooner than most states.
So then in the report, and by the way, that you can look at it on Steve's website, stopelderabusejacks.com, what do you think our state legislature needs to be looking at?
Well, first and foremost, we have to be committed to funding nursing home care. We are constantly dealing with staffing cuts, and that includes our current governor. And I believe wholeheartedly, because I've been doing these cases for 20 years, that the cuts under Governor Scott have directly led to a lot of the problems I'm seeing in my cases. Because for years, after the 2001 law was enacted, staffing levels were increased as part of the deal that was cut among all the stakeholders. And we just did not see the type of abuse and neglect that we're now seeing. And then once they cut Medicaid funding for staffing, we are seeing just horrific cases. I mean, things that are so outrageous, you wouldn't even believe it.
What's the most extreme example you've seen in your office? What case?
Well, recently we have an ongoing case where a resident was deceased on the floor for 6 hours, and they were serving this resident dinner, taking the dinner away, and nobody even called rescue or the police until 6 hours. Now, what kind of caregivers are those? What kind of facility is that just lets a resident lay deceased mm-hmm. on the floor without caring for them?
Wow. All right, let's go to some calls now as we look at the problem of digital abuse of the elderly and elder abuse in Florida, a growing issue in the Sunshine State with our big senior population, 549-2937. Roger is in Jacksonville. Hi, Roger. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to reiterate what the gentleman said. I forget his name. Family members need to stay proactive. I mean, you need to be there just about every day. I mean, of course, you don't know what's going on there, like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, you could have a person who works there had a bad night with her husband or a boyfriend come there and take it out on a patient. I mean, you have to be proactive. You have to be there every day to find out what's going on with your relative there, how they're being taken care of, adjust situations that are incorrect, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger. Joanne, do you recommend that as well? Just drop in on the facility.
Highly. And the one thing that I would say is that a lot of times the staff changes so many times, even in the period of a month or two, they don't even know the name of your patient, of your family member. They don't connect. So, yeah, stay on top of it.
Janelle in Orange Park. Hey, Janelle, good morning to you.
Oh, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me
sure.
on the line. About 5 years ago, I worked for a very well-known corporately owned assisted living facility and memory care facility. And one of your guests talked about the challenges with corporately owned facilities. And I have to agree, the focus was very much on the bottom line. And there was, at one point, when we were opening up the memory care unit, and I was concerned about the level of staffing, the person in charge of marketing actually asked if we should up staffing during the time when we were trying to fill the rooms and then bring it back down during once the rooms were filled and
Jeez.
Signed for. And so that is very concerning. I think even beautiful facilities that looked very well cared for can have significant challenges, and I highly recommend dropping in, especially at off hours when staffing levels are typically incredibly low and dangerously low sometimes.
Thanks, Janelle. So, yeah, so clearly this is striking a chord with our listeners too. Learn more about this at StopElderAbuseJacks.com. And Joanne, as seniors on a mission, not only are you trying to raise awareness about this, you also take teams of senior saints out to help seniors find meaningful work at local nonprofit organizations. So that's pretty cool.
Thank
to,
you.
To talk about as well.
We take 70, 80, and 90-year-olds on day-long mission trips.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with us. Attorney Steve Wattrell, again, that website, his report is at StopElderAbuseJax.com. And Joanne Hickox, founder and executive director of Seniors on a Mission. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
And speaking of seniors, you don't want to outlive your money. Up next, financial planner Jeanette Bajalia on her new book, Helping You Plan for the Future.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, the website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2, sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
On the next Fresh Air, Jordan Peele talks about writing and directing Get Out, his new horror film with racial anxiety at its center. It's about a young African-American man whose white girlfriend takes him to meet her parents in a wealthy white suburb. Peele is also half of the comedy duo Key and Peele. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Calling all artists, WJCT is celebrating 45 years on the radio, and we need your help to design the perfect anniversary t-shirt. Design should reflect what WJCT means to you or the First Coast community. The winning design will be featured on a limited edition t-shirt during our spring pledge drive. Get started now at wjct.org/45 years.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, she's one of America's most trusted financial professionals. Jeanette Bajalia, here in Jacksonville, is on the leading edge of the so-called longevity revolution. And while longevity can mean extra years of passion and purpose, sometimes it can also mean disease and disability and the very frightening and real risk of outliving the money you've saved for retirement. So what can we all do not only to live longer and be healthy, but also enjoy it and be able to afford our golden years, as they're called? Well, the answers are within the pages of Jeanette's new book, Planning a Purposeful Life, Secrets of Longevity. I'm taking notes. Jeanette Bajalia, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. It's great to have to be with you.
It's so good to have you on the show. And you are such a sage in this area, helping women in particular plan their financial future. So this isn't your first book, but this is a really good new look at the advice and the secrets you've learned over the years. What inspired this book, Planning a Purposeful Life?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I keep getting asked that question. In my planning, I started communicating to those individuals that I serve, both men, women, individuals, couples, and I say, okay, we have to make sure that your money does not that you don't outlive your money. So I want to make sure that you have enough financial assets, regardless of what life throws at you, because stuff happens during that retirement journey, and we need to make sure you're financially set to and through age 100. Mm-hmm. And I'd get the eyes roll and I'd say, oh no, my mother died at 72. My father died at 80. I probably won't live past 80.
You never know.
That's the point.
Yeah, you need to be prepared for that.
Yeah, and then I'm reading all the statistics. I have all the anecdotal information from my clients, and then I read all the statistics, and I see that the fastest growing segment of the U.S. population is the 90-plus. So our planning models as a team of financial advisors and retirement planners has to say longevity is redefining America. So I set out to learn more from the people who are living the longest, the 90-plus generation.
You even interviewed nonagenarians, people 90 and over, and centenarians, people 100 years old, to kind of learn how they achieved a nice longevity and a comfortable retirement. What were some of their tips and ideas?
Oh, my gosh. That's one of the chapters in the book. It's called Wisdom from what I consider the greatest generation. The first and foremost common thread from all the interviews was you can't retire from something unless you retire to something. So purpose is really the core of their existence, and they believe it's that purpose that has kept them around as long as it has.
They didn't just go out and play golf.
No, in fact, many
They're
of them—
They're doing stuff.
Exactly. Purposeful stuff, whether it's volunteering or whether it's still running their businesses, trying to mentor a younger generation to take over their businesses. And you know what's really interesting is they said golfing and traveling got old about in 9 months.
And then they looked around and said, now what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I said to them, one of my questions was, what advice would you give the soon-to-be retired generation, those that are thinking about closing this one chapter in my life and opening up? And they're very common. It said, make sure you plan for it and make sure you have enough financial assets to live well into your very most senior years.
And that's what you do with your clients, particularly you work with female clients who have a special set of challenges and concerns. And you really come honestly by this. You've been a caretaker of your own family members, a cancer survivor. You, at a certain point in your life, were frustrated figuring out your own financial planning. And all of these hard-won lessons now, you've turned to help others. And so what are some of the keys of wisdom in planning a purposeful life that people need to know about?
Well, you just said the first, and that's plan. Have an idea of where you want your life to take you. Whether you're going to be, if you're really going to be a professional mom and or a stay-at-home mom, or whether you are going to be a caregiver, because what's happening with women, what's causing more women to plunge into that financial crisis is unknowns, you know, sudden divorce, sudden having to, the kids come back home and I have to help them more. And we as women typically put others first. We're the nurturers.
Right.
So some of the wisdom tips from the greatest generation that came out in my interviews and the wisdom that I gained from my personal life experience is always plan for the unknown. And that is the most important attribute. Stuff happens. Have your plan B and plan C and plan D available. It's not just a one-size-fits-all plan.
Sure. You also counsel women, and often you've worked with women I know that they really didn't have a handle on the particulars of the retirement portfolio or what was going on with that. And then through death, their husband's death or divorce, suddenly it's all in their lap and they've got to figure out what's going on. You lead them through that too.
Exactly. And I encourage all women to get involved with their partners, their significant others, their spouses. Get involved because there's no area where gender differences are more prevalent than in the area of money and finances. It's the number one stressor in America.
Yeah.
And it's important for you to recognize that that financial induced stress is going to create sickness and disease in women. And then we spend more of our hard-earned money in the healthcare system, and that's what we don't want.
You give women and men confidence and peace of mind as they plan for retirement, and that's really worth its weight in gold, isn't it?
It is. It's worth its weight in gold, but more importantly, it gives you definition. It gives you predictability. It gives you an opportunity to say, if I didn't plan for the unknown, unfortunately, I learned it at a tough life lesson at the age of 26. I learned how a man in my mom's life was not a plan because my mother's generation was get married, and your husband's going to take care of all financial matters and take care of you. And my dad died unexpectedly, left my mom with a mortgage, unfortunately, no life insurance, and a $542 Social Security check. So at 26, I learned that doesn't get it.
Yeah.
You got to plan for the unknown.
That was a tough life lesson, but you learned it early, didn't
you?
Yes.
So now I'm able to take that and help my clients understand it's important.
Now, you're taking over the world. Jeanette Bajalia, you've expanded down to Central Florida. You're working with the website Growing Boulder. Are you doing any book signings around town for the new book?
I do. My PR agent is creating a book signing. We will have book signings all over, not only in the local area, but we'll be doing book signings on a national level. But right now, the book is on Amazon.com, and you can acquire it, Planning a Purposeful Life. And it's got some amazing wisdom from the greatest generation.
She's Jeanette Bajalia. Get her book now, Planning a Purposeful Life, Secrets of Longevity. Always great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. You can get our podcast by downloading the WJCT app. And next on 1A, does healthcare have to be so expensive? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.